This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Ms. Wessling's portion of the Johnston High School website lists her philosophy of teaching. The Iowa State graduate and head of the high school's English department says students should be valued as the reader they've been, the readers they are today, and the promise of the readers they can be. And we should teach our students how to learn, not simply what to learn. Sarah Brown Wessling, Iowa's nominee for National Teacher of the Year, went on to win that honor and last Thursday spoke at a White House Rose Garden ceremony with President Obama and Education Secretary Arne Duncan at her side. This hour, we'll hear from Wessling and find out why she loves her job in the classroom. Later in the program, I'll speak with writer Yogi Repman, author of the new book, Triumph of Will, Printer's Boy to Publisher, the remarkable story of German immigrant Henry Finner. Talk of Iowa in 5 minutes following news. And you're listening to Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese. We were expecting to have Sarah Brown Wessling with us in our studio, but she's having some problems, obviously, reaching the studio. We apologize for that. Sarah Brown Wessling was awarded the National Teacher of the Year honor Thursday in the Rose Garden of the White House. And as soon as she gets to our studio, we will discuss with her the honor and also her teaching philosophy. We'll go instead for just a minute to this I Believe essay from NPR News. This essay was sent in by Kidge Johnson of Seattle, Washington. She works at a software company by day and writes science fiction novels by night. But her belief is not about her work. It's about something deeper and darker and about the way she rose above it. Kidge Johnson's essay for This I Believe is introduced by series curator Jay Allison.
We are struck by how many of our contributors use their essays to talk about stories that even those close to them don't know. Kiz Johnson chose to write about something she says will come as a surprise to many of her friends and co-workers, but that it was more important to say it than worry about it. Here is Kiz Johnson with her essay for This I Believe.
I believe I am a climber. 3 years ago, a series of medical and personal crises took what was a clinical depression and made it something much darker. I thought of it as falling, as jumping, off a bridge on a rainy winter day, 3 seconds in the air before I hit the water and plunged deep into the icy cold, my heavy coat pulling me deeper, and the surface far overhead, too far away. This is the question that kept me from making the image a real one. What if I changed my mind? Jumping into the water, the air in my lungs would fail me before I could swim back to the living world. I would know for those last seconds that I did want to live after all, but it would be too late. I'm not sure why I started climbing. I walked through the door of the local climbing gym one day on a whim. It was an alien world. Strong, beautiful men and women, towering walls under sodium vapor lights, white dust filling the air, light instead of dark, up instead of down. It was in every way the opposite of what was inside me. The second time I climbed, I got to a move where I was sure I would fall. I was 25 feet up on a rope, but I didn't know yet that I could trust it. I heard my voice say out loud, I have a choice here, fear or joy. What I meant was, climb or don't climb, live or die. In the more than 2 years since then, I have climbed hundreds of days, inside and out, sometimes tied to a rope, often not. I do pay a price here. My body can be so bruised from hitting walls that people ask me about my home situation. 9 months ago, I broke my leg and ankle. I healed fast, but the risk remains. Next time I might not. Climbing requires a cold-blooded decision to live. If I am inattentive or careless, I will fall. Every time I climb at the gym, or rope up for a route outside, or go bouldering, which is climbing without a rope and often more dangerous, I am taking a risk, and I am committing to staying alive. Now I believe in climbing. In not jumping. Jumping would have been easy. Just step over the bridge railing and let go. Climbing is harder, but worth it. I believe that deciding to live was the right decision. There's no way to describe the terrible darkness of depression in a way that non-depressed people can understand. Now, I'm less focused on the darkness. Instead, I think about the joy I feel in conquering it and the tool I used. I am a climber, and I am alive.
Kij Johnson with her essay for This I Believe. Since taking up climbing, Johnson has also tried out motorcycling, sea kayaking, badminton, and collage making. As always, we invite you to tell us the story of your belief. You can find information about submitting, along with all the essays, at npr.org. For This I Believe, I'm Jay Allison.
Now it's 12 minutes, actually 11 minutes past 10. We apologize for the lack of a guest here in the first half hour. We do have a guest set up, however, for the second half hour of Talk of Iowa. We'll be talking with writer Yogi Repman, author of the new book, The Triumph of Will, printer's boy to publisher, the remarkable story of German immigrant Henry Finnern. Finnern came to the United States in the early 1890s with his sister Emma. They settled in Denison, Iowa with an uncle who was a farmer because of very bad economic conditions in Germany. He went on to become the publisher of the German language newspaper in Denison, later bought the newspaper after it switched over to an English language paper after World War I, put up with a great deal of being harassed by anti-German protesters around 1918. Then he went on to become a member of the state legislature. Very interesting biography of a little-known Iowan. We'll hear about that from author Yogi Repman. He'll be speaking with us from northern Germany. That's following the environment report and local weather at 10:36. Space probes have shown us what other planets look like. What do they sound like? Two scientists, one from Britain and the other originally from Romania, have explored this question by simulating a Bach organ concert on Mars, Venus, and Saturn's moon Titan. The cacophonous result is out of this world. Harry Daniels Shapiro reports.
Sit down with Tim Layton, an acoustics professor at the University of Southampton in England, and he'll tell you something's been missing from space exploration.
Almost all the space probes that have been launched to explore the solar system have been able to see with cameras, but have been deaf. They've not been equipped with microphones.
We don't really know what other planets sound like. Another scientist, University of Louisiana physicist Andy Petculescu, shared Layton's frustration and curiosity.
We would like to know what are the sounds of other worlds.
They asked themselves, for example, what would the human voice sound like on another planet? What about music? Now, this would be a difficult experiment to conduct in reality, but they realized it would be easy to simulate if you knew something about the atmospheres of other planets.
We could look through the photos of these planets, find some good craters where you'd do an open-air concert, and we could put an instrument at one end, and then we could position the audience at various points seated through this crater and see how the sound changes. What's a good concert hall on each planet?
So they held an imaginary concert. They chose an instrument, the pipe organ, and a piece of music, Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor. This is Tim Layton playing the piece on the organ at his local church in England. Layton and Petculescu took this recording and used a computer to simulate what it might sound like on Mars. They considered how the Martian air would vibrate within the organ pipes and what would happen to the sound as it traveled toward the audience. And here's what they got. It doesn't sound all that different from the version on Earth. The pitch of the organ is a bit lower, but if you started walking away from the organ on Mars, you'd notice a big difference. The volume would drop off quickly, just a short distance away. That's because large amounts of carbon dioxide in the Martian atmosphere would soak up the sound.
So sitting 10 meters from this organ going full blast, you can't hear a thing. It's silent.
They also simulated a concert on Venus. Supposing for a moment that the organ and the audience could withstand Venus's crushing pressure and searing heat, Bach's Toccata would be slightly higher in pitch. This is Petrulescu's favorite planetary rendition of the piece.
I find it eerie, and I think that's cool.
To highlight the differences in the music on different worlds, Leighton and Petrulescu held an interplanetary concert. They simulated organs playing simultaneously on Earth, Mars, Venus, and Saturn's largest moon, Titan. And the result? Not exactly the ethereal music of the spheres.
I'm glad it doesn't last much longer than it does. I think I can stand about 30 seconds of it, and then that's about it.
Leighton insists this research has some practical applications. Scientists could use the same approach to simulate the sound of extraterrestrial thunder, wind, and earthquakes, so when an astronaut or probe does land on another planet, we'll know what we're looking for.
The era of the astroacoustician is coming. People who will really work hard to put acoustics into spaceflight.
Leighton and Petrulescu expect that future probes will be equipped with microphones, and they're eager to hear what other planets really sound like. For The World, I'm R.A. Daniel Shapiro.
Now it's 17 minutes past 10. We're missing our guest here for the first portion of Talk of Iowa. We apologize for that. We do have a guest, though, for the second portion. Speaking to Yogi Repman, author of a new biography of a little-known Iowa immigrant who ended up in Denison, Iowa, lived in Waterloo for a while, and went on to become a very important philanthropist and state legislator. His name is Henry Finnern. We'll hear about his life at 10:36 as a part of Talk of Iowa. Following Talk of Iowa at 11, Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and today journalist Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker of the Philadelphia Daily News. They just won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. They exposed a crooked police narcotics squad, which resulted in the review of hundreds of criminal cases. We'll hear from them at 11 on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. The House Agriculture Committee held its first hearing on the Farm Bill in Des Moines on Friday. On The Exchange, live at noon today from Iowa Public Radio News, we'll talk with Bruce Babcock, director of the Center for Agricultural and Rural Development, and others who testified in Des Moines about the changes needed and likely in the 2012 Farm Bill. That's at 12 noon today on The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, hosted by Ben Kiefer. Then at 1 o'clock today, Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Almost 40 years ago, a group of students gathered in protest at an Ohio college campus. The Ohio National Guard attempted to disperse them. Shouts and confusion abounded. Shots were fired. And when the smoke cleared, four students were dead. Remembering Kent State, Rebecca Roberts hosting that discussion. 1 o'clock hour, Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Skies are mostly clear, just a few clouds in east-central Iowa for the rest of today. Partly sunny, just a slight chance of isolated thunderstorms this afternoon. Highs today, mid-60s to the low 70s. Lows tonight, low 40s northeast, low 50s in the southwest. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, becoming partly sunny. Highs, mid-70s to low 80s. It's 10:19. 20 past 10, Talk of Iowa continues. We're missing our guest for this first half hour. We apologize for that, and we have a couple of features for you, and then the environment report coming up at the bottom of the hour here on Iowa Public Radio. Next, Therese Peterson started volunteering as an actor in the Underground Railroad reenactment tour in Detroit in late 2005. She says that if she wasn't given the opportunity to play the part of the conductor who leads visitors through the tour of the Underground Railroad Living Museum, she might not be with us today. Therese talks us through the tour and tells us how being a conductor changed her forever.
Steal away to Jesus.
My name is Therese Peterson, and I play the part of Comfort, who leads you through the Underground Railroad at First Congregational Church in Midtown Detroit.
My name, Comfort. And I's here to take y'all to y'all freedom. Y'all's better be ready to go once we start. Ain't no turning back now.
So we start our journey. And our first stop is Junebug and June Nelly.
Who left?
It's Comfort, Junebug. I's got a package.
Junelli and Junebug always gives Comfort a hard time because they never want to go to their freedom. They want to stay.
Freedom is safe. Freedom is where I am right here.
No.
Us ain't going nowhere.
And mentally, they are so brainwashed and messed up that they believe that their master loves them and that their master cares about them.
Yeah, he loved me. He loved me. He loved you now. And he loved our children.
Master don't care nothing about you.
So Comfort doesn't give up because she believes that one day, hopefully, if it's not too late, they'll change their mind. And actually, before I played the part of Comfort, I played Junelli. In that moment of my life, I was in a very unhealthy, abusive relationship, and I was afraid to come out. I was pretty much like Junelli. I was trying to find reasons and excuses to stay rather than to leave. This is my comfort zone. This is where I'm supposed to be. I started thinking differently about my marriage, like in between sets, because after one group goes through, you have to sit and wait for the next group. So in between sets, I'm sitting there thinking, this looks familiar. I'm acting just like Junelli, trying to convince myself, okay, he loves me. He cares about me. I love him. What, leave? I don't know what I'm afraid.
Don't you let nobody else take your freedom from you. God didn't put you here to be no slave.
When my role changed in the Underground Railroad and I started doing Comfort, the conductor, after a few times, I'm like, okay, look at Comfort.
God gave me the strength.
She's strong.
To help my people.
And even if she is afraid, she's not allowing fear to paralyze her, to stop her. She's responsible for getting these people free. And she's moving. And she's grooving. And she's doing her thing. I'm like, okay, now if Comfort can do what she's doing, why can't I do it? Why can't Therese come up out of this situation where she's losing herself? She's dying every day. So I took a stand, and I left.
Freedom!
By the grace of God, I made it. I made it.
Minutes past 10 o'clock. You're listening to Talk of Iowa. We had obviously a problem connecting with Sarah Brown Westling, the Teacher of the Year, and we apologize for that. Sarah Brown Westling not being able to be with us in the studio today. We have a few minutes left. I wanted to at least play a couple of audio clips. Of course, as many of you know, she was named the National Teacher of the Year last week and appeared at the Rose Garden with President Obama to receive her award on Thursday for National Teacher of the Year. Sarah Brown Westling teaches at Johnston High School. We congratulate her. She's been there for 10 years. She taught 1 year at Cedar Falls High School. We'll play a little bit of audio before the break. First, the first audio cut is President Obama talking about this national award winner from Iowa.
We are in northern Germany.
Obviously, that's we'll have the right cut here in just a second. Here is President Obama.
Whether teaching basic writing to at-risk freshmen or literary theory to advanced placement seniors, Sarah writes, I see a story in every learner, unique and yearning to be read. That's why she creates individualized podcasts for each student with extensive feedback on their papers, prompting one parent to report that his own writing had improved just by listening to Sarah's comments to her daughter. To his daughter. Sarah also helped develop 15 new courses this year alone, taking into account a wide array of interests and learning styles. And her students don't just write five-paragraph essays, but they write songs, public service announcements, film storyboards, even grant proposals for their own non-for-profit organizations. One of her students reports that in Sarah's class, no discussion was fruitless, no assignment was pointless, and not one day was boring. And I'm not sure I could have said that when I was in school.
President Barack Obama, speech in the White House Rose Garden on Thursday as he gave the Apple Award Teacher of the Year, National Teacher of the Year, to Sarah Brown Wesley. And then Sarah had some comments of her own following the president's remarks.
If you were to come into my classroom, the first thing that you would notice is that my desk is in the back corner. Despite the building design to make it otherwise, my desk is in the back corner. This is but an outward sign of an implicit philosophy. Teaching must be learner-centered. The desk in the back of the room displaces hierarchies, creates an environment where a teacher becomes a lead learner, evolves into a web of interdependence where the classroom walls become boundless. When we embrace this open model of learning, the consumers of our curriculum will become the designers of their own learning experiences. I am here today because my students couldn't be. When we listen to our students, their message is clear. LaBria would say that she deserves worthy learning experiences. Robert would want to be seen as an individual, not as a number or a score on an exam. Meredith would clamor for innovative instruction. Yasmina would say she deserves passionate teachers. They all would say, we need 21st century teachers, not just adults teaching in the 21st century. Our dream for our students is the same dream we have for our own children. To be recognized for their strengths, to learn from their weaknesses, to be seen as people of infinite potential. Sometimes it is difficult to hold on to what's good in this profession, but each learner is a story. I see the world in stories, and I believe it is these stories that will sustain and teach us. They will challenge and sometimes confuse us, but in that very same way that I believe in the transformative power of language to unite us, I am certain that the stories of our students will sustain us.
Sarah Brown Wesling, the National Teacher of the Year from Johnston High School in Johnston, Iowa, the Des Moines metro area, speaking at the Rose Garden at the White House on Thursday. President Obama giving her the award just before that speech, and you heard some audio from the president as well. We apologize. We weren't able to connect with Sarah Brown Wesling this portion of Talk of Iowa. Talk of Iowa follows, continues, and with the environment report, and then hear about a very interesting new biography of a German immigrant to Iowa. His name is Henry Finnard. We'll talk to author Yogi Repman following the environment report here on Talk of Iowa. Talk of Iowa continues. I am Dennis Reese. Took a lot of guts for two German teenagers, the oldest 14, to make the trip from Schleswig-Holstein in Germany to Denison, Iowa in the early 1890s. The parents let them go to live with a farmer relative in the southwestern Iowa town because economic conditions were so bad in Germany. Henry and his sister Emma thrived. Henry apprenticed at the local German language newspaper, survived a hostile anti-German mob at the beginning of World War I, went on to purchase the newspaper, later served as a philanthropist and state legislator. Yogi Repman, who teaches at St. Olaf and Carleton Colleges in Minnesota and lives half the year in his northern German town, has written a biography of Henry Finnard called Triumph of Will. I called Repman last week. He's in his hometown a mile from the Danish border.
We are in northern Germany. The state north of Hamburg and south of Denmark is called Schleswig-Holstein, like Holstein cow, or the city of Schleswig in Crawford County, Iowa, north of Denison, and Holstein in Ida County. And we are just a mile south of Denmark, a harbor town located at a fjord which leads into the Baltic Sea.
You can see Denmark from your backyard, right?
Yes, yes. Okay. And the very best hot dogs.
We should clarify that Yogi is your nickname, that you have a proper first name, which is...
Joachim, J-O-A-C-H-I-M. And this is a strange German sound, the C-H.
Mm.
And I'm, Dennis, to be honest, just happy to have this American-type nickname.
Well, let's talk about the book, a very interesting biography of a German immigrant to Iowa who moved here when he was about 14 years old. He was born in 1877, Henry Finnern. He and his sister, as teenagers, made the long trip from Germany to Iowa. Can you tell a little bit of the story of why they decided to move here?
Over 7 million German-speaking immigrants came from 1830 to 2010 to America. And the vast majority, Dennis, of these 7 million German-speakings or all these European immigrants to the United States, the vast majority came because of social and economic reasons. They were starving in Europe, they were starving in Germany, and they were starving in my home state in Germany, Schleswig-Holstein. So the amount of adventurers or the amount of emigrants who came because of political, religious reasons is very, very small. So in the case of Henry Finnern, Henry, the American nickname or the American version of Heinrich Finnern, is the same. And his parents, his father was a shoemaker. There were several siblings, and the parents, even though they worked hard, could not feed the kids. So in a way of desperation, Henry and his sister were sent over 1891 to Denison, Iowa, because there was a relative, an uncle who ran a farm, and Henry and his sister came to Denison. And then the uncle realized after a few months, Henry is quite a bright little lad, but he was not made to be a farmhand or by any means a farmer. So the uncle found for Henry Finnern an apprenticeship at a newspaper to do an apprenticeship as a printer.
Funny thing is, he just missed Ellis Island, the new federal immigration station, had not yet opened, and it was after the time of Castle Garden, so he didn't get to see the magnificent new structure when he and his sister arrived. Is that right?
Very right, very true.
Was part of the reason that Henry made the trip to America with his sister, was he trying to avoid the draft in Germany?
The state of Schleswig-Holstein had been part of Denmark for several centuries, and then in 1864, Prussia and Austria, under the leadership of the Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, the capital of North Dakota. Many young men tried that, but in the case of Henry was 13, 14, was even too young. It was some years ahead of his career. But in Henry's case, the main reason had been starvation, the fact that it was so difficult to feed your family for many people in Europe, in Germany, in his home village.
Anyway, he gets to Denison, and you say he worked as a farmhand for his uncle, and he was a little, I guess, puny for some of the farm work, maybe. But he lands this wonderful job at the German language newspaper in Denison. How many German language newspapers were there in Iowa cities and towns at this time, the 1890s?
Many. We know the number, for example, all over the United States in 1880, nearly 900 daily and weekly newspapers. The city of Milwaukee, which was called German Athens, north of Chicago, had in 1852 three daily German newspapers and over 80 weekly and monthly publications, high-quality philosophy journals in German and so on. And I estimate all over Iowa in 1875 or so, probably 80, 90 daily and weekly newspapers.
And when he started his job, there were no linotype machines. How did they actually produce these?
Hard manual work. Again, for Henry, quite a challenge because of his physical appearance. One of the very first African-American families in Denison, or maybe the first African-American family in Denison, man, the father of the family, worked as the hard laborer to print the newspaper. It was just raw, tough work to get every single page printed by itself.
Until the gasoline engine came along where they could make the process move a lot easier without so much physical labor, right?
Very well, very right.
He goes on to eventually purchase the paper, and he's running Denison's German language newspaper. So he really took to this line of work quickly, didn't he?
There were several steps in between. He also worked for a while for the English-speaking weekly newspaper, and then there were two German weekly newspapers. And just a little footnote, what was moving for me, Dennis, in 1978, as an undergraduate student, I came to Schleswig, Iowa, Crawford County, and I wanted to find out why did this name Schleswig from my home state, Schleswig-Holstein, and we have the city of Schleswig, a little bit south of my Flensburg, German hometown. How did this name came over in 1899? And while I did research in Schleswig, Iowa, in Crawford County, my hosts, retired farmers, couple, they suggested go down to Denison to the library. So I did, and for the first time I was reading the weekly newspaper, which was owned and run by Henry Finnan, and I was stunned by the quality of journalism, and even more emotionally moved, Dennis, because every single weekly issue of the German weekly newspaper had a long farm report about the German state of Schleswig-Holstein. What does it tell us? The chain mass migration of North Germans from my home state of Schleswig-Holstein, Germany, came to Iowa. It had started in 1847. Whole groups, the first three groups in August 1847, came not through New York, Baltimore. They came through New Orleans, up the Mississippi, through St. Louis, to Davenport, Scott County. And Davenport, Scott, and Clinton County became the center of the Schleswig-Holstein German immigration. And then along the railroad tracks, cities, villages like Schleswig, Crawford County, Holstein, Ida County, Manning, Iowa, was founded 1882, Manning, Iowa, vastly populated by North Germans from Schleswig-Holstein. And in Denison, we had the surrounding Crawford County, Stockholm Township. We had Swedish immigrants and North German immigrants. So there were so many Schleswig-Holstein farmhands, poor North Germans, who compensated their homesickness reading every single week about how the weather, the farming, the crop in their home turf, Schleswig-Holstein, had been. And that started my interest in Henry Finnan in 1978.
How many people lived in Denison at this time?
2,500.
And how many were German speakers?
Denison, and you have to see sort of the surrounding townships, the whole county of Crawford County, and altogether, in estimate, maybe 10,000 Germans.
Oh, that's a lot. And so he probably had a pretty decent circulation for the news. Yeah. But I want to get up to this interesting time, Yogi, of the start of World War I, which for German Americans had to be just a terrible, terrible time. And it peaked in 1918 when things really got bad. Do you want to talk about that?
But the First World War was an amazing, a terrible challenge for all Americans with Germanic roots. And in Iowa, in the Midwest, Nebraska, Wisconsin, the majority of citizens had Germanic roots. And it started slowly in April 1917. America entered the First World War with General Pershing, who had Germanic roots by himself, like Eisenhower and many others, or Sandra Bullock these days.
Yeah.
So in April 1917, when America entered the First World War, the First World War German Army and Germany were regarded as the Huns, the barbarians. Propaganda, sure, from England, the Allies. So in America, in rampant anti-German hysteria had been built up. In the case of Denison, for example, and Devonport and many places, quite on a large scale, book burning at the end of the First World War took place. So in Denison High School, the German textbooks from the Denison High School were put on a pile, were burned down. We know from Iowa librarians, they took, even though they were professional trained librarians, they took German-speaking books out of their shelves, and they were destroyed. This was just a mood that anything with Germanic roots were just dangerous. For example, and in a way now entertaining and funny, Dennis, one of your few Germanic words like sauerkraut had been renamed to liberty cabbage.
Yeah, yeah.
German measles, I think liberty measles, Beethoven as a Germanic composer were taken off the orchestra, symphony orchestra in Boston.
You even had town names and street names being changed, right?
Exactly. And for the case of Schleswig and Holstein in Crawford and Ida County, they were so German that the mob from Dow City near Denison, who also went to Schleswig, Iowa, and demanded a name change, the mayor of Schleswig, Iowa, Jimmy Schultz, knew about that this group will come, expected the group of mob, around about 25 cars with 80, 90, 100 people, welcomed the mob, and then the mob realized, while Jimmy Schultz, the mayor of Schleswig, was talking to them, that from every window, rifles were pointed at them. So the mob left. Jimmy Schultz kept the name Schleswig for his little nice town. But the railroad administration in Chicago was so mad that they took the name Schleswig from the schedule, from the printed schedule, and just gave Schleswig and Holstein a number for several years. In the case of Henry Finnan, Sunday, October 4th, 1918, round about 400 people came from Dow City to Denison, Iowa, started having a fire behind the newspaper publishing building of Henry Finnan. And Henry Finnan was called, went to that group, first got letters from Washington, from different institutions, that his newspaper was more patriotic, supporting the American First World War case than any other English newspaper in the area.
He certainly had to be scared for his life standing there in front of that mob, wasn't he?
Exactly, because somebody said, lynch him and kill him from that group, and no police officer was in town. Mm. The sheriff had left. So it was an organized, orchestrated activity of the mob. And Henry finally gave a speech, brave and in a way a hero, in a really, truly American hero, and gave a speech and said, today, Sunday, tomorrow on Monday, my weekly German newspaper will be published in English. That's how he saved his life, and that's how he saved his newspaper.
Probably helping the situation was the fact that he spoke excellent English, didn't he?
In his career, in his early career, After the apprenticeship at the German newspaper, he had worked for some years for the English-speaking newspaper. He was a community leader. He was very strong in the Missouri Synod, not only in his church, even on a national level. He had founded the association to raise the money for the German Opera House. Donna Reed, for example, had her first activities in that theater, which was remodeled lately in Denison to a beautiful, stunning historical quality. And Donna Reed has Germanic roots, Donna Bella Mullinger. Henry, in his short autobiographical sketch, is looking back years later to that day where the mob of Dow City showed up in Denison as the darkest day.
Well, so he agreed. He tells the mob, sure, I'll go ahead and switch the paper from German to English. And as it turns out, that's sort of technically a difficult thing for him to accomplish. You just different linotype machines and a lot of challenges to do this. But he did. How long did it take for him to go completely English on this paper?
I know sort of the last, I have seen and studied intensely the last German-speaking newspaper and then the first English-speaking newspaper because he was absolutely fluent in English, in writing, speaking, writing high and low German. So for him, that was easy. A bright guy who taught himself. He just had a few years of a poor village school in Germany and was an ardent reader. The English weekly newspaper supported him. So in many respects, the English community always liked Henry Finner. But I stress it, if you have this hysteria mood, Dennis, if you have this 1917, 1918 rampant anti-German hysteria, well, it is out of control.
This certainly couldn't have made the German-speaking subscribers in Crawford County and the vicinity happy to lose their German newspaper, right?
Right. Well, the business community realized in 1917, early 1918, the mood all over the country was that advertisements to German-speaking newspapers were just not a smart marketing move. For example, 1851, one of the very first German-speaking newspapers in Iowa had been founded in Davenport as a weekly. It became a very successful daily newspaper. But then in 1918, end of 1918, the owners and publishers, the Lischer family, still around, very rich, successful business people, decided to stop the whole publication because business, the German-American business community in Scott County, Davenport, had decided to do less and less advertisements, and the same development all over the United States, especially in the Midwest.
What was the last German-language newspaper in Iowa? How long did it last, do you know?
We know of German newspapers, as a matter of fact, called Nachrichten von Schleswig-Holstein. News from Schleswig-Holstein had been a monthly Germanic newspaper in 1942. During the Second World War, that was still published. And I'm not aware of a German-speaking weekly or daily newspaper in Iowa after that.
So there was one that lasted until the early 1940s.
Yeah.
We should mention that this anti-German hysteria was not helped by Governor William L. Harding of Iowa, not exactly an enlightened figure, who at some point prohibited the speaking of any German anywhere in the state under any circumstance.
And he was a laughing figure all over the United States, because one of these activities of that governor, five farm ladies in Scott County talked on a conference line on the phone in low German. Well, they didn't speak English because on the countryside there were so many immigrants And even first and second generation, there was no need for these farmers and farmhands to learn English. So they spoke low German, and somebody heard about it, and Governor Harding started a lawsuit and so on. So it was up to ridiculous aspects, and Governor Harding was sort of an extreme patriotic guy, and in those days they were called super Americans.
We just have a minute or so left. I want to just kind of wrap up the story of Henry Finneran's life. He, after things calmed down for him after the war, he had a very long career as a newspaper publisher and postmaster, just a remarkable public servant. And he also served in the state legislature, right?
He was an impressive, self-made man. He was a family man. He was a community leader. He was very generous with donations. And the dot on the I is that his youngest daughter, Norma Finneran, is still alive in Loveland, Colorado.
Yogi Redman, thanks a lot. Thanks for writing the book and letting us all learn about the life of Henry Finneran. I'm glad you did this.
Thanks. All the best to Iowa.
Yogi Redman teaches half the year at Carleton and St. Olaf Colleges in Minnesota. His biography of German immigrant Henry Finneran is called Triumph of Will, published by the Hesperian Press in Davenport. That's Talk of Iowa for today. Talk of Iowa, production of Iowa Public Radio News.